This is Spencer Keeble with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and today I'm joined by Dr. Margaret Flowers, a pediatrician who practiced for 17 years and was director of pediatrics at a rural hospital. And then in 2007, Margaret left her practice to advocate full-time for a national improved Medicare for All single-payer healthcare. And she's been involved in many efforts to advocate for single-payer healthcare. Thanks for joining us, Margaret.
Thank you for having me.
So how are countries with single-payer healthcare systems responding to this COVID-19 crisis as compared to the U.S. response?
Yeah, so if we look around the world, most wealthy nations have some sort of a universal publicly financed healthcare system, some version of a single payer system. The United States stands, is unique because we don't have that sort of a system. And what we particularly see is countries like China, South Korea, Venezuela, Cuba. These are countries that are actually handling the COVID-19 crisis very well because they have a universal system that is able to centrally coordinated. And so they're able to resources where they need to be and mobilize people, physicians, health professionals to where they need to be and take the necessary steps to control pandemics like this when they occur. The United States has been, completely unprepared for a pandemic, even though people have been saying for a long time that this is, something that is going to happen. We were not able, not ready to deal with it, and particularly because our healthcare system is a privatized system that puts profit first before health, unlike these other countries. We're seeing, all kinds of confusion and scrambling and price hiking and all kinds of behaviors that really go against what we would need to be doing to handle a crisis like this.
So how might the U.S. response to COVID-19 be different if we had a single-payer healthcare system?
So China, immediately when there was a physician who reported a cluster of cases in one of their hospitals that was unusual, they immediately mobilized people to get on it. The government did. It's a very centralized planning type of government and, asked researchers to get to work right away identifying it. Then they were transparent and shared that information. And then they took steps, once they realized that this was person-to-person transmission and that this was something really unique and concerning. They took steps to make sure that people were quarantined, particularly in the areas that were, worst hit, and then to have people stay inside. And then they set up these teams, these public health teams. In Wuhan province alone, they had 1,800 public health teams of 5 people in each team who were responsible for tracking the positive, people who tested positive, locating their contacts, finding out who their contacts were, testing them, isolating them. So they took a very scientific approach to identifying where the virus was and then, locating people and putting them in isolation. They were able to shift 40,000 health professionals to come to the areas that were hardest hit. And they also took steps to support people while they were quarantining by suspending their rents and mortgage payments, making sure that they were able to get food, they were getting food deliveries. We see the same kind of thing in Venezuela, where they took steps, even before they had their first case reported, they had a plan put in place that people were made aware of. And then when they had their first 2 cases that were identified on the same day, they immediately, closed schools, put people into self, quarantining. And then they had a website that people, over 12 million people out of a population of about 30 million, filled out pretty quickly about how they were doing, if they had any symptoms. And then they were sending teams around to people's homes who were reporting, concerns, medical teams, to check on them and test them if necessary. They were able to get tests. Russia and China have been helping them out because of the blockade that the United States has imposed, which makes it difficult for them to purchase the things that they need. China and Russia have been sending tests and other supplies to them to handle the epidemic.
So have some of these other countries you mentioned been able to mobilize their response quicker and in a more concerted manner?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, this is where in a crisis like this, you need you know, I think everybody kind of expected that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would have a plan and, you know, that things, you know, resources would be mobilized quickly. And we're finding out that that's not the case. And plus, the administration has been kind of working against them, initially trying to play down the crisis. And definitely with considering sending workers back in 2 weeks, you know, putting the profits of or the economy before the lives of people. And so what we're seeing is that there's no real central planning saying, okay, you know, Washington State, we need to mobilize resources and positions to Washington State. And then when New York, which is really, you know, being very hard hit as the time of this recording, New York has more cases, positive cases, than Spain, than Germany. And Governor Cuomo is really struggling. He's asking the federal government for help. It's not forthcoming. States are in a bidding war with each other to try to get the protective equipment that they need, to try to get the ventilators. Governor Cuomo asked the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to come in and help out. Trump wouldn't deploy them to help with converting spaces into, you know, hospital beds. And so we're just kind of seeing this as the same thing in the European Union. You know, when Italy reached out to the European Union for resources, they said no, because each of the different countries was more concerned about its own needs than it was about the health of a member of the European Union, which is being really hard hit. So it's the opposite of, you know, the solidarity and the cooperation that we see in other countries like China and Venezuela and Cuba. You know, we're seeing this competition and lack of concern for human life in countries that are more dominated by more of a white supremacist capitalist attitude.
So you mentioned that the U.S. hasn't really responded as well as some of these other countries with single-payer systems. Do you think that the American people are seeing this, that there has been somewhat of a failure to respond? And do you think that this is leading people possibly towards supporting Medicare for All or a single-payer system?
I think what we're seeing out of this, there had already been strong support, public support for a national improved Medicare for All or single payer universal healthcare system. And I think what this crisis is doing is really exposing the flaws in our current system and that it, you know, how incapable it is of dealing with a crisis like this. So I do think that we're going to see even more of a push for that type of a system here in the United States coming out of this. I think that, you know, the European Union is, it's interesting because you're seeing countries like Serbia who reached out to their European Union for help and were denied. And so they turned to China. Italy similarly has turned to China, Cuba, and Russia for assistance. So I think we're going to see some realignment possibly in kind of the global power dynamic following this. And I think the United States is going to come out in a poor position because instead of, you know, taking appropriate action in our country, supporting other countries, we're actually doing the opposite. And the United States is imposing more economic measures against countries like Venezuela and Iran that are making it hard for them to get the supplies and resources that they need. We call them sanctions, but they're not actually sanctions. They're a unilateral course of economic measures that are designed to try to weaken those countries. And so we're taking a very punitive approach as opposed to a cooperative approach. And I think as people learn about this in the United States and, you know, see the harm that this does, I think hopefully there will be a push for big changes, both in our healthcare system, in our economy, in our foreign policy, to, you know, be policies that are more humane and reasonable than what the United States is doing right now.
So if we had a single payer system implemented, how do you think that would look like? How might our lives change? How might we see U.S. policy change?
So, you know, if we had a national improved Medicare for All system in the United States or some sort of a universal single payer publicly financed healthcare system, the main way that that would help us out in a crisis like this is that health would be the priority rather than the profits of the corporations like the pharmaceutical and insurance industries. And what we would be able to do is we'd have a national system in place. We'd have a national database where we could monitor what's happening in different parts of the country. We'd be able to have a plan to get resources where they're needed. The federal government would be the purchaser of the supplies and pharmaceuticals for the healthcare system. And so you wouldn't have this bidding war between states. States would be able to say to the federal government, we need extra masks or we need extra ventilators. And the government would provide those because it wouldn't be a kind of a profit type of thing. And you would also see more hospital beds. The United States has been losing hospital beds, even though our population is growing. So back in 1975, we had 1.5 million hospital beds and about 210 million people. Now we have less than a million. We have 925,000 beds, but we have 330 million people in our country. So hospitals would be given a global budget to operate, and they wouldn't be shutting down because they wouldn't have to worry about making a profit to keep their doors open. They would just be getting a regular check from the government. And then finally, another key thing is that there wouldn't be any financial barriers to healthcare. So people would not be staying away from the doctor as they do now. A third of our population delays or avoids care because they're worried about the cost. People would know that if they needed to get a test, it would be paid for. If they needed to be hospitalized, it would be paid for. And so we wouldn't have these barriers in place that keep people, you know, from getting diagnosed and getting appropriate treatment and potentially being out in the community infecting others.
So could a single payer system prevent some of these preventable deaths? And another aspect that is mentioned a lot in the single payer debate is how will we pay for it? Do you think that it's possible to save lives and save money at the same time?
Absolutely. And the United States, when there have been studies looking at the number of preventative deaths in various wealthy nations, and the United States always does the worst because of our fragmented healthcare system that has so many financial barriers in the way. And so we have over 100,000 preventable deaths every year in the United States just because of our system. If you look at the United States, where we have people who are going into kidney failure or having strokes in their 40s just because their high blood pressure is not treated, you know, when you have a single payer healthcare system, it actually starts to impact a lot of your policies. You know, we have a lot of things going on in the United States that are bad for health, the food that we eat, the amount of pesticides that are used in the foods. All of these things we end up paying for in the poor health outcomes in our healthcare system. And so you would really see a whole change in the priority of our public policy in the United States when it is actually the government that is responsible for taking care of the health. They want to actually going to save money. And you mentioned the cost of a single payer system, and studies from across the political spectrum that have been done looking at it find that a single payer system would be less expensive than the system that we have right now. So it would shift the payment, you know, would be paid for through our federal government, but overall the cost of the system would be less than what we're paying right now. And it would slow the rise of healthcare costs because you can do the bulk purchasing of goods, which means that you can get a better price for them. You would not have insurance company middlemen who are taking so much out of our system in terms of paperwork. We spend a third of our dollars just on bureaucracy, way more than other countries spend on administration. And those dollars should be going to actual healthcare, not paperwork and paying really literally an army of administrators. The amount of people that are administering our healthcare system is really bloated and very expensive.
Yeah, that's true. It was even mentioned earlier in this single payer series, almost half of a physician's time is spent on administrative procedures, whether it's paperwork or dealing with the thousands of different insurance plans that they have to fit their care within. So reducing some of that wasted time could lead to better outcomes and more patient care. And it also seems like single payer system could focus on what is regarded as the triple aim, the access, the care, and the cost. It seems like it could benefit each of these main facets of the healthcare system. So why don't we have nationwide support for this single payer system that you've mentioned would benefit us in so many ways?
Well, I think, you know, in many ways we already do. In 2017, you know, when after Trump was inaugurated and there were a lot of town halls regarding healthcare, you really saw in all across the United States people coming out to their Congress members, even in, you know, throughout Kansas and in the South, which are typically more conservative areas, people were pressing their Congress members and saying, well, why don't we have a single payer healthcare system? And one thing that the Affordable Care Act did that was a positive was it expanded Medicaid. And so a lot of people now have an experience of, oh, you know, actually, when I am not able to afford healthcare, it's nice having a system, a public system that's there for me to take care of our health. So I think it's really kind of changed the way that people feel about this. And it's reflected in polls as well, looking at conservatives. They don't want to get rid of Medicare or Medicaid. So what it's really going to come down to is the demand, is people have to be louder and more forceful in pressing our members of Congress to say, you know, we're not going to put up with this any longer. And, you know, to be savvy enough, and I think that's happening, to understand that a lot of the solutions that presidential candidates and members of Congress are putting out there are not going to work. They're trying to keep the current system in place and just patch it up a little bit. And that's just not possible to make a functioning system out of what we have. We need to expand the good parts of our system, which is Veterans Health Administration, which is a nationalized health service, or Medicare, but it definitely Medicare needs to be improved. And that's why we always say national improved Medicare for all.
Yeah. So the national improved Medicare for all single payer healthcare system is something that you've advocated for since 2007. You were even a congressional fellow during the health reform process in 2009 and 10. After practicing medicine as a pediatrician for 17 years, what motivated you to shift to advocacy?
Yeah, well, you know, in the United States, particularly for people who are primary care providers, the burnout is happening pretty quickly. And so for primary care doctors, you know, they're burning out of practice in about 10 to 15 years. And that's because of the way our healthcare system is designed. And for me personally, it was, you know, as soon as I came out of residency, I was working as a hospitalist in a rural hospital. And every time I admitted a patient to the hospital, the insurance companies would then, you know, tell me how long my patient could be in the hospital. And that didn't always fit with what my patient needed. So I had to negotiate with the hospital administration and say, look, you know, this child is not ready to go home. We have to figure something out, whether it's you excuse, you know, the rest of the cost that the insurance isn't going to cover, or we're able to pressure the insurance company to give more days. So that was a constant fight with almost every patient that I admitted. And then I was out in private practice, and it was a fight with the insurance companies. You know, I would write a prescription, and then my patient would go to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist would call me and say, oh, well, you have to get authorization for this. So then I have to stop seeing patients and get on the phone with a, you know, with an insurance company to get authorization for a medication. Or we're a small private practice. We've struggled to get paid. The insurance companies were constantly, you know, putting obstacles in our way to pay us. And so, you know, we were struggling as a small pediatric, you know, practice to keep our doors open. And then just fighting with, you know, what your patients need, if they needed a test or whatever. It's a constant fight with the insurance companies. And so it starts to wear you down. You know, it's frustrating, and doctors find that they can't even communicate with each other the way that they should. I always took pride in having a good medical record. I wanted my patients, no matter where they went, that a doctor could pick up their chart and know what was going on with them. But now doctors have to use kind of different language. They don't put things in the chart because they know that their patients might not be able to get care if the insurance company sees certain things written in the chart. So it's really undermined our integrity and our ability to practice something that we've studied, you know, and prepared for. You've got these administrators telling you, basically practicing medicine, but malpractice, because their goal is to deny paying for care. And so it starts to really hurt people, you know, and health professionals. And then the other thing was, I just saw a lot of my colleagues who I thought were some of the best doctors leaving practice and going into administrative positions because they were getting frustrated. And I thought, you know, this is not going to stop unless we do something about it. And so I tried to do advocacy and practice, and that just, I felt like I needed to be engaged in it full time if it was going to make any difference.
Well, Dr. Margaret Flowers, thank you for your dedicated advocacy, working to serve the healthcare needs of everyone in our country, including those most vulnerable, and seeking to make sure that everyone has access to quality healthcare.
Thanks for having me on.